Hi, welcome to Tangent. I'm Edward Cohen.
Hey there, this is Jeffrey Berman.
Today on Tangent, we have Matt Ellis, CEO and co-founder at Measurable, the ESG platform built for real estate, serving $2 trillion in asset value and 17 billion square feet across 93 countries. Hi, Matt. Where does this pod find you?
I'm calling in from Telluride, Colorado, so southwest core of the state.
Also excited to welcome our guest co-host, Nina Misages, climate tech investor at Decarbonization Partners, the BlackRock and Temasek JV investing in next-generation innovative decarbonization solutions and businesses. Hi, Nina. Welcome to Tangent.
Great to be here, Eddie.
Before we get started...
Wait. You're not going to ask her where she is? Come on.
Where are you, Nina? Where is this podcast finding you?
I think like 40 streets north of you is where I'm at. So Hudson Yards.
I was hoping for something a little bit more exotic. But
why? Because you're calling in from your closet, Jeff?
That's where I'd like to hang out. I don't know what that says about me, but that's where I'd like to hang out. The acoustics are wonderful.
I can tell. Yeah, you do sound good.
The plot twist is that Jeff's background is actually a virtual background.
No, that's real.
I believe you. Before we get started, we need to congratulate JB on his jackpocket exit to DraftKings for $750 million. Jeff, congratulations. Were you expecting this deal now?
Sort of. It's been a 10-year journey for Pete and the team. And I actually posted something on LinkedIn about the importance of investing with amazing people and the perseverance and persistence it takes to get an amazing outcome. And that's actually a great segue to talk about the guy that we've brought in, Matt Ellis, because we've known Matt for a pretty long time, right? Since 2016. Is that right?
Yeah, 2016,
2017?
That's right.
And yep. Matt, when he started his career or started Measurable, was probably barking into a box with nobody in it, right? Like it just wasn't something that people were really thinking about. Saying very similar to what Pete Sullivan and the Jackpocket team did, right? They saw a need. They said, why doesn't this exist? And they executed on it, but it took 10 years of really hard work to get there. Measurable, very also similar in that it's taken a long time for, I think, the venture community and the real estate community to understand how important it is to measure what matters, which is, by the way, title of a great book, and it's in their name, Measurable. So, Matt, thank you again for being with us. This is one that I'm really excited to dive into.
Right on, Jeff. Thanks for your support. When you guys led the Series A, yeah, it must have been around about 2017, and I think we began to see for the first time that there was, like, I wasn't shouting into the wind, right? You guys were getting some feedback from your LPs and your network that this thing that we call sustainability or ESG, it is real. It is material to the real estate business. It is going to transform the way we transact. But there's still, between then and now, was many more years of education, market development, not just by ourselves, but by regulators and investors too, to get to the point where today we could actually have this podcast. We could talk about these issues and people will not just go, what is this again? What's the E, S or G? Now we don't have to do that so much anymore.
No, definitely. I mean, in terms of playing a crucial role in driving education and adoption in the industry of these standards. But before we jump in and understand, you know, where Measurable comes from and what you guys are up to, let's set the stage here, Matt. Help us understand what exactly are we measuring in real estate or supposed to measure in real estate when it comes to ESG? I mean, what are some of the key data points or North Star metrics you found to have more impact across buildings and cities?
Yeah, well, let's go all the way to the top first, and then we'll work our way back down to some of the specific metrics, okay? And so it goes more or less like this, and you've heard this repeated too often. It's not actually entirely accurate, but we're all largest asset class, real estate, that one is true. Roughly 40% of global carbon emissions. That's actually not true. It's about 38.5 according to the UN, but a lot of our friends like to round up. And it's not exactly from the buildings. It's from the activities that are being conducted within those buildings. So it's important to be precise on this.
It's
a measurement thing, right? We want to be accurate here. So when we take those two things together though, Ed, you start to really get your arms around this. The enormity of the opportunity, the challenge, right? Which is we have to have a successful transformation to sustainable real estate in order to make a meaningful dent in climate those things have to go together. There's no future without the real estate industry moving along. Now, to make those changes, it gets back to what Jeff said and your question, which is you start fundamentally with measurement. So when I began my career at CBRE, this was a subjective, not an objective. We talked about, quote, green. We didn't use the term or the jargon ESG. It wasn't understood that there was a financial merit in this conversation. It was a platitude. And what we have done, I think, to change that is get down to the numbers that you're after. What are those numbers that matter? Yes, there are things like carbon emissions, for sure. There are also things like water consumption, raw materials. That's where we start to get into things like embodied carbon, not just operational carbon. You need to measure and can measure all these things. There are health and well-being implications of real estate. So indoor air quality actually does matter. There's a whole raft of them. But if I had to give you the five most important, based on our work out in industry, it is carbon intensity, energy intensity, physical climate risk exposure, flood, wildfire, hurricane severity, certification status, think of things like BREEAM or LEED, Energy Star ratings, and regulatory exposure. Is our asset in a geography like you guys, Nina and Ed, are in New York, or DC for that matter, Jeff, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they're exposed to an expectation from a regulator that to measure, report, and disclose. Those are the five. Those are observable facts. You can measure those things and you can transact against those things.
Super interesting. And the way measurable is approaching it, it's you know, you guys are covering the entire real estate cycle, right? So it'd be great to understand for our audience and ourselves, what are some of those use cases, you know, at the asset level, at the portfolio level, and also at the index level, to really understand how you're taking a holistic approach here, not just, you know, measuring things here for buildings here or companies there, but actually following, you know, the entire real estate cycle as it pertains to ESG.
Yeah, this is critically important. And this is an unusual aspect of measurable in our particular vision for market transformation. What we identified is that real estate is not just brick and mortar. It's also debt and equity. And people fail to remember that other part, which is odd because a few minutes ago I was pointing out this is the world's largest asset class. This is about loans. This is about insurance. This is about bonds and securities like CMBS. This is about ratings. This is about index products, ETFs, BlackRock, Nina's parent org, right, being a particularly large player there. If you don't change the preference of capital and use metrics and data and transparency to allow them to transact differently, then nothing will happen. You can go change all light bulbs you want, but if I change the cost of your capital, that's far more powerful. And that's what Measurable has accomplished as we talk here today. We have made it possible to get the data from the most minute aspects of buildings, boilers, chillers, BMS, sensors, submeters, recognizing that that's the beginning, but not at all the end. So we took that data across that asset, enriching it with the other types of metrics that I described, certification status, climate risk exposure, CapEx projects, and so on, all the way across the entity and the fund. So doing that at scale, getting your arms around, again, we'll use BlackRock, one of our great customers, a significant institutional owner of real estate across multiple countries, and then making sure that that data moves all the way back out to the capital markets so they can change the cost of that bond and its coupon rates so they can get better access to investors, LPs, and equity. And then around the wheel it goes. That's what Measurable is all about, is delivering that platform. We say meter to market, end to end. Does that help?
That absolutely helps. So as an example, just more concrete examples, I saw how Boston Properties, one of your clients at the asset level, are using carbon technology from Measurable to monitor their lease commitments. Can you talk more about that?
That's right. And that's a wonderful, incredibly progressive and sophisticated ownership. The largest public REIT out there, BXP. And they have pioneered their relationship with their customers around sustainability, just as they should, because what's the real estate business? Also, it's about providing shade and shelter to businesses. And so if you're not using sustainability with your tenants and with your occupiers, you're failing. And that's what Boston Properties is doing. They're using it with their customers, their occupiers, Wellington being a prime example, where they're doing net zero leasing, and they are using our technologies around what we call granular carbon emissions or real-time carbon. So Measurable can tell you exactly point by point second by second, what's happening on the grid and how that relates to your particular asset in terms of its carbon emissions. So very verifiable, very accurate. When it comes to a financial commitment like a lease, that's what you need. So it's just one example of how BXP uses our technology.
In the heart of Silicon Valley, there's an organization making waves in helping solve the housing crisis, Housing Trust Silicon Valley. At Housing Trust, they provide developer financing, homeownership assistance, and lender and broker resources to help create more equitable and affordable communities. Established over 20 years ago by local businesses, community leaders, and affordable housing activists, Housing Trust Silicon Valley uses transformative housing finance and public and private partnerships to create a strong, affordable housing market. From those experiencing homelessness to developers, renters, and first-time homebuyers, Housing Trust SV is dedicated to ensuring that every neighbor has access to safe, stable, and affordable housing. Housing Trust SV is making a difference in the 14 counties of the Greater Bay Area and Sacramento. These are communities with a common need, more affordable housing and the capital to support its development. Join the Housing Trust SV in making a lasting impact on our communities. Housing Trust Silicon Valley, where innovation meets compassion. Learn more at housingtrustsv.org.
So, Matt, these buildings, they are central to many stakeholders. You have the tenant, you have the building manager, you have the building owner who is sometimes has them as part of a portfolio, there's regulators, and we're seeing changes in interest towards sustainability from many of these entities, including some, there's consumer reports that are coming up that consumers are voting with their wallet. It would be great to understand who is really driving this change? Who is the person that's knocking on the door saying, this is information that has to be collected, and this is information that has to be available?
Let's do the top three, okay? Because I'm sure I'm going to forget some important ones, but the top three are definitely will resonate here. And they've changed in their order of priority, which is fascinating. So number one today, this was not true 3 years ago, is regulation. So your regulators around the world, look at Europe, look at EU EPCs, and no farther than that. Okay, fine, look a little bit farther. Look at CSRD and SFDR. From asset level to entity level, there are prominent and meaningful regulation compelling you, whether you like it or not, to measure, manage, report on sustainability performance. And they hit, by the way, because of the size of the real estate sector, and both in terms of asset value and carbon, they hit the real estate community particularly hard, those regulations. Definitely true across North America. There's shadow regulation almost. So look at stock exchanges who enforce sustainability disclosure in order for you to be listed with them. We just did a very exciting partnership with London Stock Exchange with more to become or to come out on that later this quarter. But it is public, so I can talk a little bit about it, which is building whole index offerings around sustainability. Do you want to be in that index or not? And if you do, you want to be measured or to participate. So it's almost like, yes, I have to be, if I'm public, I have to be in those indices. So by in fact, it's almost de facto regulation. The number two, Nina, is the money. And that's where we began this sort of transformation in real estate. It was APG, PGGM, the Dutch pension funds, among others, who came out and said, this is material to our risk and our reward in investing in real assets, and we need to know. And that revolution, I mean, you could trace it back over 20 years, but certainly in the last decade, that really picked up steam and began there. The third driver, and that still remains very powerful, but the third driver is the customer. It's the occupiers. What we just talked about with Wellington's. But if you're in the market today, you're a credit tenant, your government, your healthcare, your high technology, your bank, you have this expectation. Why? Because for many corporates, the lion's share of their emissions and their impacts is in their real estate. So those are the top three that come to mind. And I think they remain very powerful and they kind of jockey for position as the years go on.
And following up on that question, some of these stakeholders have impact on the economics of these buildings. So, and here what I mean is you can, to tenants, can you charge higher rent prices to financiers, can you get a better cost of capital? I mean, regulation, maybe it's sometimes it's more, it's either fines or it's binary, you can operate or you can't operate. Could you provide some color as to how you're, what changes you're seeing in the market or how this information is impacting how the markets are behaving?
Sure. So historically, when I was at CBRE, we commissioned studies and we worked with the gentleman, Norm Miller, Dr. Norm Miller, the University of San Diego. My hometown, and we looked at the correlation between ratings, LEED, and certifications, LEED and ENERGY STAR and asset value and lease rate. And we found a statistically significant relationship between if you got it, you're worth more, and if you don't, you're relatively worth less. And so we would talk about that as the green premium or the brown discount. Choose either way is fine. And that was not the first study and certainly hasn't been the last. Most recently, I've seen some work out of Oxford. You've got Maastricht University with Nils Koch and Pete Eichholz, who have done great work on the correlation between asset value and sustainability performance of buildings. So there's a nice academic body of work out there that is fresh and saying over and over again that certain types of assets are enjoying better tenant lease up, lower operating expense, therefore higher NOI that caps out higher asset value. So that's, we've got on, but I don't think that's the most interesting part of this. And I think it's the part that people tend to fixate on is the asset level. But what we're talking about earlier, when you can change your cost of capital at the portfolio or entity level, that's the game changer. So let's go back to Boston Properties and remember what else they've done. They've issued a couple $1 billion in so-called green bonds. And when they do that, their experience is that they have more demand from a larger pool of investors, which means their borrowing costs fall. And if you move the basis point just a hair on those bond issuances, that's extremely meaningful. So that it doesn't, you don't have to look just at the asset and its trade value or lease rate. You can also look all the way up at cost of capital, share price, right? Remember that the London Stock Exchange, it's the FTSE Russell EPRA Nareit indices, and there's a green version of them, and you look at who's included. BXP, Prologis, the prominent real estate institutional owners who tend to have lower cost of capital, which is a great competitive advantage. So that's where you see it.
It's interesting how the drivers for sustainable transformation across the built environment are seem to be like all coming together finally. Whereas if it started from one sector, if it started from the investment side or started from the occupier side or the activism side, and now it's trickled up to regulation here in the US. Always wondering, like, what will it take? How far away are we? Or how can we get to an understanding of like common ground in what like success will look like, right? We have local law 97 in New York that it's like aiming to reduce emissions by like 40% by 2030, I think it is, and net zero by 2050. I mean, all these years sound like really far away, but like actually 2030 is right around the corner already. So yeah, I started thinking about this when I was randomly watching this video about the history of soccer and how only when people agreed on the rules and agreed on everything is when like the sport really started proliferating and becoming not only a great business, but also a great driver for social change. So like, how can we agree on the rules of the game? Where we want to get to. I know, incentives are wildly across the board, like, and not as aligned as we'd like them to be. It's a complex industry, complex world. But how can we get there, or what will it take us to get there?
I think this is where you're spot on, that we've got a real problem. The problem of sustainability, there's a myth, that the problem of sustainability is a problem of the lack of technology. It's not. And I'm not just referring to technology like measurable. I'm talking about the pie in the sky and people think that you need to have some really fancy new building tech. It's not, guys. It's basic lighting. It's basic light retrofit work. Yes, some deep retrofit too, but it's not for lack of the materials or the light bulbs or the variable fan drives and so on. It's a myth. It's not expensive to do. It's impossible to do. The fundamental block is the ability to reconcile the incentives. And this is where your question goes. What's a green building? Go ahead, tell me. There's four
painted green.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And you know what? That's like the only definition I think we could all get here and agree on is the problem. I just had a debate with one of my good friends in the industry, Chris Pike, over at GRESB, the Global Real Estate Sustainability Benchmark. We're talking about the role of certifications. How many different certifications exist for sustainability in buildings? The answer is well over 100 around the globe. So I'm an institutional investor. I'm a decision maker. I'm an occupier. I'm trying to find the thing that represents that, quote, sustainable performant building, the one that's lower risk, higher reward, and so on. How do I do that? I can't make heads or tails of all these different certifications. The quality vastly different amongst those certifications. I can't see the data is the ultimate answer. And then it gets down to this question of, well, what data? What's material? I gave you five statistics when we started this call. As far as I can tell, there's five things that actually change the preference of capital decision-making. And yes, there can be more for certain niche groups, but for sure we got five. But I turn around, I look at GRESB, and I love those guys. They've done tremendous foundational work. We're looking at well over 100 metrics, which then get aggregated and rolled up to some score, some star. When I was in kindergarten, I used to get a star from the kindergarten teacher, right? I was a good boy. Is that really what we're doing in the real estate business? And my background is in traditional real estate. I did corporate real estate leasing. We don't do this. What we actually do is we go get lease rates and compare lease rates. We go get net CAM charges and we compare CAM charges. We get comps. Right now, you cannot get a comp around, quote, green sustainable buildings. And the way to change, I think, this problem is to get a definitive comp. And that's really the backbone of what Measurable is trying to do, is to provide the data so we can make objective decisions one building to the next. I understand the buildings are somewhat different. It doesn't prevent us from buying and selling or leasing them. Why should we have the same, or why should we be able to do that same thing when it comes to the sustainability performance of that building? We should. We should be able to do that for any building, anywhere in the world. And it's a matter of getting the data. So that's what we've got to get to. The change that we need is alignment on the core metrics, not standards and certs, metrics, data. And we should do what we've always done in real estate, transact against those data points.
Yeah. I mean, I just walking around New York City, I do notice the LEED certifications, and they usually are in newer developments. But the city issued certificates here, I mean, I haven't come across an A building, maybe one. Like most of them say D, or I don't know if there's worse than D, but in terms of the efficiency from an A, you know, A, B, C, D. So either New York City's buildings are the least efficient around there, or those qualifications are...
But it's also, it's a part of the interruption. It's also, yeah, as Matt said, it's not just the buildings, it's how they're being used. So buildings, like for instance, I lived in a building when I was still living in New York City. I lived in a building that had a D, and it was a brand new building and beautiful building. Got a D because the lights all over the building were always on. The power, like the HVAC, was always on. It didn't matter if people weren't in the rooms, like the big ballrooms that this place had, always heated or always cool. So that kilowatt hour usage contributed to the fact that this thing was just not running efficiently. And yes, they could have done things. They could have changed their lighting to LED lighting. They could have changed their BMS system. They could have put in, I think they had an opportunity to put in some kind of carbon sequestration capture. And I didn't know how this worked at the time. I didn't know such a thing existed. But I actually recently reached back out to the developer and asked. So it's not just perhaps the buildings themselves are not sustainable. It's the use and the way that they're being used. Matt, would you agree with that?
Do agree with that. And we talked about this earlier in our discussion, right? I was making the point, like people are lazy when they say the whole 40% of carbon emissions from buildings. It's just not true. Not only is the number not accurate, and that's a couple of gigatons difference, but it's the usage of and activities within those buildings. And we need to get down to that, because what we're talking about is the business of real estate and our relationship with our tenants and how we serve them. There are absolutely going to be very energy intense buildings, but that doesn't mean that building itself is a bad building. Look at what's the Salesforce building in Bryant Park. Isn't that a Rudin building or whoever it is? Mm-hmm. At the time, it was one of the most efficient and performant buildings out there, but they've got data centers. Is that wrong? Does that make that a bad building? I don't think so.
I like the nuance there. Yeah, definitely depends on the usage, depends on how we use it. I'm sure even within the same use of the building, we're going to see wild discrepancies between ways to operate it. So in terms of collecting all these data, how does Measurable I mean, got to start with collecting it, but just curious about your whole data stack. How are you collecting it? How are you analyzing it and, you know, making it digestible for real estate players and everyone across the real estate cycle?
Sure. The way it goes is we've, over 10 years now, built out proprietary technology, in-house technology, to do the fundamental capture of data. And when we say data, like kind of capital D, I'm talking about a lot of different things. People reflexively go to the utility data. That's true. You have to be able to access utility bill data and pull that in, scale the across portfolios of real estate. You need that for the whole building, not just the common areas owned by and controlled by the landlord, but the tenant areas as well. You need to be able to access device data, which we do as well. So again, I mentioned the
mice,
boiler chiller,
vice?
The BM. Vice, well, not the mice. We don't care so much about them, but the actual building components, BMS, for example. Mm-hmm. So these are like some of the building blocks. We need to define that building. This is not unique to sustainability, but every real estate technology company out there has got to know what is that object and what is its breakdown and composition. So we just talked about usage. So in our system, we're actually really interested in what we call space and meter assignments. Space is the Starbucks in the first floor lobby. Second floor is Bank of America in their data center. And, you know, maybe it's a housing on top or a hotel. We need to know. Those uses really matter. And we need to know the consumption by each space. So architecture, call it your data model of the building, really matters. And then you keep going. You have to attach the certification data. You have to attach the project data. So those customers of ours are always making improvements in their building. We don't have a bunch of lazy landlords. We have landlords that are very passionate about improving their assets. And they don't necessarily even think about it as sustainability initiatives. They'll be doing it because they're doing a retrofit of the lobby to make it more attractive. But while they're at it, they're improving and the building performance. You got to track that. We need to know the ROIs, we need to know when it was done, who did it, and so on. So we could keep going, but this is what is fundamentally happening is everything that I just mentioned. Measurable's goal in life is to bring a technology solution to that data acquisition, data cleansing. So you could benchmark and quality assure that data. And then of course the outputs of that is getting it back out from the customer to their stakeholders.
And Matt, when real estate managers, owners get this data, and there's obviously this initial just like learning about your own building and how it benchmarks to other buildings that are similar. What are the main levers that are available for these owners, managers to improve their performance? How would you describe what's like kind of low hanging fruit? What is a little bit of a stretch and what is really maybe not even available right now, but only available in some places?
One way to be facetious to improve your sustainability performance is just get rid of, sell, transact, right, consciously, and get rid of the stuff that's not so good. Right now in this market, that's a little easier said than done. But there's a certain truth to that too. Like, what are the levers that ownership pulls to optimize its portfolio? Transact consciously, right? Understand which assets are at peril from climate hazard or regulatory risk, or flat out require substantial investment, and then underwrite and understand that. And then everybody out there that owns buildings is in the business of turning them around to make profit by and large, unless you're the Irvine company, hold forever. And so you want to make sure your actual acquisition disposition strategy understands the sustainability costs and benefits. I think that's another easy miss out there, because the tempting way to answer that question is to say we should do lighting retrofits. Yes, you should also consider that, right? But because it's a transacted asset class, it's leased and it's sold and bought, we should look there too and consciously bring sustainability into those pre-investment due diligence activities so you don't get the bad building in the first place, or at least you're very aware of what you're going to do to change that. And then the other part is operational investments. I think that's pretty well-trod territory. I think we get that there are readily available and convenient technologies. I think you manage your energy mix, use procurement to your advantage. I think you should do behavioral investments too. So that's where you work with your tenants, your property managers, and make sure they're educated and understand how to incentivize the right behaviors, because we said earlier that this isn't entirely within our control. There's these tenants in there. So if you just did what's in your control on those investments, and you wouldn't be able to move the needle all the way to the right.
And Matt, many of these improvements, even if you are not even looking at sustainability or green premiums, they have a cost benefit to them, right? These are energy. A lot of the on-site improvements are just energy optimization changes. So if these technologies are available, what are the main challenges? Why are we not seeing more buildings introduce these energy optimization solutions?
It's a nuanced one because...
Money.
Well, I would actually argue you are seeing that. You're seeing incredible adoption of technologies to drive changes. And I'm not even talking about putting new stuff in. Like one of the things that we offer a tool called Asset Optimization. One of the things it does, it looks at the existing operations of the building and simply makes recommendations on how to tune that. It's called like active commissioning. We didn't buy anything new there, to be clear. We simply improved the way that the building operated in terms of startup shutdown and other considerations. So I kind of wince when we say, are we not seeing real estate do this? I argue, actually, you're seeing incredible change in the real estate community. What we're not seeing was we're not seeing it go down market. So we just talk a lot about BXP or some of the other amazing institutional owners that are doing rooftop solar and green bond issuance. And that's measurable's customer base.
Right. And measurable. But that's part of the challenge. It's money. Right. Look, you alluded to this earlier, right? One of the big drivers, and you said this wasn't a big driver certainly not 5 or 7 years ago, regulation. Regulation is the great equalizer, because once it becomes regulated and promulgated, then you have no choice. And then every building owner up and down market is going to have to figure out how to make their buildings work in this new environment. And the other thing I'll say is that when you're talking about, like, Measurable has the blue chips of the blue chips. They have others that aren't blue chip, right? Measurable applies to across the spectrum, but there is one thing in common, which is these buildings tend to be the ones that people want to lease from. And so those owner operators have the luxury of saying, we've got the money to be able to invest in our buildings to make them more sustainable, getting the data that people care about and measuring what matters in a way that down market might not necessarily have. And so there's this clustering effect. But part of, like, our thesis at Canberra Creek is we're investing where our limited partners can help accelerate the growth of companies. And we've only done 40 some odd deals in the 16 years that we've been in existence. And part of the reason for that is that most of these companies don't have the ability to generate a real venture return opportunity. Whereas when you look at a company like Measurable, which has such a massive market in front of it, even you're talking about the class A, the most, and let's say class A and class B, primarily class A, in the made on main, those big operators. It's such a massive market that this made a lot of sense to us. But a lot of the other sustainable solutions that we've seen on the market, either they're not really that disruptive, they're not providing the value that they say they're going to provide, or they're not distinguished from one another. And so that's also part of the reason why the psychology of the industry is, let's continue making as much money as we can before investing in what is a nice to have. Regulation makes it a need to have. And I think that's when that comes to the, when those begin to get enforced, then in the game, they'll look very different. But the ones that made the effort and spent and the investment with time, energy, and dollars, they're going to be in the best position to continue capitalizing on a trend that is not reversing.
I really appreciate that question too, Nina, because you're right. I feel that very viscerally, where people, like, the industry is not making the progress it needs to. And I do think it's a tale of kind of two cities, two cohorts. It's the converted, figuratively, I mean, the institutional money that has the incentives that Jeff's talking about, the carrots were there. And now you see the sticks to come in and kind of move the baseline up to capture the mid-market real estate, the mom and pop real estate, which is, by quantity of buildings, the vast majority of it. And one place to look, by the way, that's really exciting is that I mentioned debt and equity. I think the debt is really cool here. So to help out with that long tail, we will announce later this quarter a major bank deal where thousands and thousands of borrowers, buildings who have loans, are coming on technology. Those buildings are not going to be direct measurable customers. It's their lender That's cool, because that lender will then go on and consider sustainability performance and start to incentivize the different interest rate changes. And that's how you're going to get to the mid-market. I don't really see the same things that drove the first movers happening in mid and down market. I think it's going to be your lender. I think it's going to be your insurer, right, who come and force change.
You stole my next kind of segue here. I think two crucial players in this space to drive adoption, whether it is with carrots and sticks or a carrot stick, is lenders and insurers, right? I mean, and I wanted to ask you about what are we going to do with all our coastal real estate? And I'm thinking Florida. I'm thinking, you know, places where we have a lot of, well, I've seen with my own eyes that we have rebuilt the beach because there was no beach anymore. You know, it's not, you don't have to look at any reports. You just have to go to the beach for a period of 15 to 20 years in Florida or anywhere else that we've seen sea level rises quite dramatically and impact the real estate there. So are all these going to get poor kind of quality scores, or what's your recommendation there? Like, are we going to have to do an Amsterdam and try to cohabit with water and canals? Like, what's it going to take there for us to stop building or to basically make these buildings on coastal cities more resilient?
I think you said the answer. There's plenty of ink spilt on this topic. But what I find most fascinating is when you talked about Florida, or we can certainly look over at California, what do you notice? Multiple major insurers vacating those markets. Mm-hmm. What happens? Costs go up. That's really, very, very real. My adopted hometown in Telluride, just down valley, they rezoned it in terms of fire risk, and insurance premiums went through the roof. And I had a friend of mine who was under contract to buy a house and couldn't get insurance and couldn't close on that property. So what happens to that property? Its value falls. So you're going to see this burn, and the sophisticated money understands that and is pricing that in or not transacting there. But I really think it's going to be this very visceral change where someone looks at the premium and goes, I can't afford that. Or that thing that changed the cap rate, that operating income, because the insurance premium is so much higher, and just hits you in the pocketbook in ways you wouldn't expect. And they'll never even see that as a quote climate hazard or sustainability risk. It'll simply be a matter of insurance. So that's how you're going to get change in preferences. People will always live in Florida. I grew up in California. I still drove to LA and saw every one of those beautiful houses up on the hills of Malibu. And there's always at least one of them kind of sliding down, but there's still a rich guy right behind ready to take a spot. That's going to happen, but they can afford it. That's the key.
And Matt, you've been talking about the origins of Measurable, originally targeting the financiers, then now like regulators are coming in, and there's now lenders are your new frontier market. Where do you see Measurable going? Where will Measurable be in 5 to 10 years? What are your frontier markets? What do the next few years for Measurable look like?
Very simply, aspirationally, Nina, we would have done the job of making sustainability, pun intended, measurable. And so the way that I look at that is we would go around in the industry and we would be able to say, are you measurable, yes or no? If you are, you have data. I can transact with you. I can insure you. I can lend to you. I can accurately assess the value you're building. That's when our job is kind of, quote, done. Fundamentally, we would have provided that classic economic solution of transparency to make markets more efficient and work better. That's what we're doing. Now, to get there, a couple trillion in real estate, and how big is the market? Ed or Jeff, Nina, 80, 100, hundreds of trillions in real estate asset value around the world. We're a long ways away from providing that objective measure of sustainability to buildings. We've got a nice start, and that's all it is. In order to get to the next place, we need to become a transactable digital signal score or set of metrics. I think it is a FICO score, something that's widely used to understand that sustainability cost benefit. If we can get there, that's not a technology barrier. I think we can always make our technology better. And any of my customers who are listening would be telling me do exactly that. But there's also this other thing is, do you get the consensus of the market? Do you get that agreement? And if we can strike that agreement, it goes back to Ed's earlier point, which is we don't have that right now. So you can't transact on sustainability at scale. We got to get that agreement in place. That's the thing that will spend a lot of our time and energy on. And we're, you know, to do that, frankly, we just have to get more and more adoption until there's a tipping point there. When our customers get a phone call from their investor, the investor says, do you have the data? So yeah, no problem, I'm measurable. And they go, okay, we're good. We can move. That's the project right now. Does that help? Does that answer the question?
Absolutely.
Cool. Love
the ambition. Matt, measurable right now is active in 93 countries. I mean, that's almost half of the countries, according to Sporkle.com. But basically, what are there any like example out there countries that are doing a better job either at driving adoption or at least hosting the conversation, or any particular cities that are leading the, you know, the forefront of sustainable real estate?
Wait, did you just cite like Sporkle.com as your authoritative source?
That's my authoritative. Sporkle.com is what I did during college. Okay, that's why I know about countries and I don't know about anything else. So
cool. That's my All right. I'm going to reference check that. So are there countries or cities doing this boat better? I don't know. It's the classic duopoly here is like Europe and North America. And I heard once upon a time, one of my European customers, they said very politely, painfully politely, they said, what you're doing over there in the States is what we like to call market-based. And what he means is chaos, right? It's like every city going off and doing their thing, and every state going off and doing their thing, and the feds are hanging out going, what do we do? And maybe we'll think about carbon this way, climate risk that way. It's chaos. And the idea is that these best ideas and best practices, of course, congeal and win. And you do see some of that. I think we've got in the States an agreement along major metros that you should measure and benchmark and disclose. And then you have the folks who have gone farther, like New York, Cambridge up next, with financial penalty. Now, Europe, I think, is a simpler way, although they've had massive, massive fights and pain, and it's still not done. But at least they have the EU EPC system. And anyone in Europe right now is just going, hold on, like, record stop. That is fraught. But it's the right idea that we would have this consistent labeling effort with this a common set of data behind it, and that they would open up their utility infrastructure to make that easy to do. In Europe, you have pan-European EU-level regulation that sets consistent playing rules of engagement. I think that's the right idea. So I think it will make, and I see more... As a result, I think it is a bit easier, certainly in the long run, for European real estate organizations to address this issue. Americans have to be North Canadians. They're looking at every asset differently. Now, that's difficult and expensive. So I think there's something to be said for consistency and uniformity. Right or wrong, I don't know. Just the way business works.
Yeah, I mean, especially in this part of the world, we hear about a lot about comparisons between North America, Europe, naturally. Funny enough, or not funny enough, but yeah, China being the biggest contributor, the single biggest country contributor to carbon emissions. But that's neither here nor there. Matt, collaboration superpower. If you had to choose one person, historic or living, to do a partnership with, to collaborate with, who would it be?
Well, there's only one obvious answer right now. It's Taylor Swift, because she can literally change elections. She's like, I mean, are you guys watching this right now?
No, what
Taylor is everywhere, everything. So yeah, I want Taylor to promote our brand, and then we would have this answer that I was trying to give you earlier, which is how do you make it really go to scale?
I love that answer, because
I stand by that too. I absolutely sincerely mean that.
They're saying that if Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce have a baby, it will drive like the next baby boom for millennials and Gen Zers who are delaying having babies. So there's wild speculations about Taylor Swift. So
I've heard more than one of those conspiracies about her, yes.
Jeff, are you a Swiftie?
Well, I think she's tremendously talented. Matt, you just gave me a wacky idea.
So you're going to get Canberra Creek is going to get Taylor to promote the portfolio companies, or what's the idea?
I am going to keep it to myself because it's so wacky. So wacky that it's like, it's almost too wacky for even me, but my God.
No, I'm going to call you after this. We hang up and figure out what's going on.
You won't be able to get me. I'm jumping into another meeting, but I have to. Let me see if I can do it first. Wow, what a great!
Let's make it happen. Measurable at the next Super Bowl with Taylor Swift,
Matt Ellis.
Just I guess it's only seven. Jeff, that the ticket on that is, by the way, $7 million for 30 seconds. So, like twice the size of our A round or whatever.
A
round right there.
A sustainability is priceless. So What's 30-second ad? Right, Matt Ellis, CEO and co-founder at Measurable. Thank you so much for coming to Tangent today and enlightening us with all your tremendous work and what your team is up to helping the industry modernize and become sustainable.
Nice talk with you. Thanks for having me, Nina. Likewise.
And Nina Messages, thank you so much for gracing us with your knowledge and questions.
Good being here. Thank you for having me.
If you like what you've heard, please subscribe, rate, and review Tangent and share the show with a friend. This episode is produced by me, Edward Cohen. Thanks for listening to Tangent, and remember, collaboration is our superpower. So stay curious and always be learning.